Be gentle in how you judge these first two. We're trying to introduce you to this vast and complex world with seven different geographical locations and cultures, and you've just read the first two pages of a long story.
Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of the website EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, and today Dr. Serena Higgins visits to give an initial reaction to The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power show, based on Season 1, Episodes 1 and 2. Tolkien, of course, was friends with C.S. Lewis, and that's why I'm drifting from my usual direct focus on Lewis. About the first 10 minutes of today's show is spoiler-free, so if you haven't seen the first two episodes and want some general information, then you're in luck. If you've seen those shows and are still scratching your head about what to think of them, then what Serena shares will be helpful to you as well. Plans are to do another show on this topic once all episodes of the Season 1 is finished. Welcome back to All About Jack, Serena.
It's very good to be talking to you again, William.
Before we talk about the Rings of Power itself, let's address what the show covers and likewise what it does not cover. That is, what text were the writers allowed to use and why is that important to understand?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and it's an important principle to lay down before we get into the details. The showrunners have the rights to The Lord of the Rings, including its appendices, and The Hobbit. And that is pretty much it. So they are covering the second age of Tolkien's history of Middle-earth. So for those who might not be familiar with that, the third age is what we mostly know, because that's when The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings take place. So this is some thousands of years before that. But Tolkien did not write a huge amount about the second age. He did write some about it in the Silmarillion, but they do not have the rights to that or to the unfinished tales. So they're working with a limited set of texts.
Exactly. Right now, yeah, most people, if they've listened to me, know that this is not my area of expertise. Sure. I don't come from a literature background, but I did read enough. Actually, not before watching the first two episodes, which is, of course, what we're discussing. So people listening to this in the future or after the first season will understand if we don't make some obvious points that become obvious right. Once you've seen those other shows. But anyway, that it doesn't go into the other material that is out there. And so people familiar with it, which actually is not myself, but yeah, thank you for clarifying that. Now, let's not go into too much detail about these first two episodes, but what is your initial reaction to those first two episodes? Is it covering the period of Middle Earth you were expecting, and or how is it doing so far? Because again, it's only two episodes of the eight from the first season that we are talking about.
Right. It is covering the period that I expected. There is a prologue that gives a very quick overview of Tolkien's first age, which is about what I expected them to do, and then it jumps right into the events of the second age.
Okay. Well, now, highlight what you liked about the episodes as a TV show in general, and then as a Tolkien adaptation. I think it is important to distinguish that, because that's why maybe people either love it or hate it. I've seen that there's really no middle ground to the majority of the reactions.
That's exactly right. And it is important to make that distinction. And that also is a distinction of audience, right? Are they making this show for the real Tolkien fans who know the lore and speak Elvish and have an encyclopedic knowledge? Or are they making it for the casual viewer? So I think it is important to try to evaluate it from both of those. So just as a TV show, I most enjoyed the visuals. It is an absolutely beautiful show. The sets, the scenery, the costuming, the cast themselves, it's just a visual feast. It's a very great pleasure to watch it. And they have both huge landscape shots that soar over the land that are beautiful, and then really careful details. So on subsequent second, third viewings, you might notice detailed Elvish embroidery on a cuff or something like that, or a significant symbol on the hilt of a sword. So it's absolutely a visual spectacle. So I certainly enjoyed that as a TV show. I enjoy the cast. It's very well cast, in my opinion, and the actors are top-notch. Really, really compelling acting and characters, and I look forward to seeing how their character arcs develop. As a Tolkien adaptation, I found it more difficult to get into because they're working with such limited material, but as we'll discuss, they make some significant departures even from that material. So that's a little hard to adjust to, because you might think, well, if they have so little, certainly they should use every little detail they have and then just fill in the blanks where we aren't given something by Tolkien. But because there are significant changes, that was a little tough. But you asked me to talk about what I liked as a Tolkien adaptation. I liked that they are using the Elvish language Quenya. They're using the Dwarvish language as well. And side note, they have a diction and language coach who is just marvelous. She is amazing. Her work is so good that she's actually changing the way we Tolkien scholars pronounce names and words from his universe, because she's really accurate. So I liked that. There are some scenes in which I felt like they really nailed the tone or the atmosphere or the feeling of Tolkien's work, and maybe we can talk about some specific scenes. Well, more generally speaking first, I thought that the locations were one of the best aspects as a Tolkien adaptation. We get to spend time in Lindon, Eregion, Khazad Dûm, and I did feel that they captured those places from Tolkien's lore. So if your desire is to visit Middle-earth, then I do think that's one of the strong points of this show as a Tolkien adaptation.
Very good. Yeah, I know one of the things with a different show, which doesn't matter what it is, that I will listen to other commentary about it, and they note about costume and design. And so now I more so look out for that, so to speak. And so when I did the second viewing, I was especially able to enjoy just the atmosphere that they created. It's very well in terms of a TV show overall. And such. So, well then, okay, so you shared what you liked then. Likewise, what did you not like about the material in terms of a TV show, and then in terms of the Tolkien adaptation, which I assume the latter is going to be longer than the former?
Well, unfortunately, yes, there are several answers to that question. But this is also a matter of perspective and comparison, right? We're expecting so much of this show. There's been an enormous marketing campaign. There's so much hype for this show, and it's going to be the most expensive television show ever made. And then you bring to that also people's passionate love of Tolkien. There are very, very high expectations. On a first viewing, I was quite disappointed. I've watched it 3 times now, and I am liking it a little bit more on each viewing. So let's dig into some of the details of what was disappointing. The most disappointing aspect as a TV show is the dialogue. The dialogue strikes me as being very poorly written, quite cheesy, unrealistic, and that's surprising to me because the showrunners are brilliant, articulate, well-spoken people. Now, of course, they don't write every line of dialogue. Each episode is written by members of a writing team, and perhaps we'll see their skills in the overall arc of the story as it unfolds. We've only seen 2 hours out of 50, but the dialogue strikes me as being quite poor. The pacing of these first 2 episodes is a little odd. There are moments that seem to drag, and then moments that rush by, and far too much is happening in just a few quick seconds. And then there's the aspect of things that are made into mysteries that don't necessarily need to be mysteries. And I wonder, again, is this a marketing ploy, or is this something that is going to develop and be more meaningful over the course of the story? Furthermore, many of the characters and their development so far is quite cliched. The show seems to be very stereotypical, boiling down a much more complex and nuanced tale into a simple revenge plot. And many, many stories of, oh, can I trust this person that I just met? People aren't what they seem. How do you know who to rely on? And so forth. So in short, my disappointments in it as a show were that it seemed too formulaic, too overdone, not original enough. But there's still time for them to redeem that.
Along those lines, are touching on some aspects in terms of the writing.
Yes.
Again, from more of a layperson, so to speak, although with like C.S. Lewis, known as, you know, challenging people to make sure a quote is by Lewis, and there's a lot of, shall we say, cheesy things out there attributed to him.
Yes.
Having said that, I want to go back and watch again. And I noticed, and I didn't write down any lines. Maybe there might be lines that were actually some of the better ones that you may have found. But there were some where I was going, ooh, that is a good line that's foreshadowing some stuff. But then also, I guess in terms of writing, there's always a challenge to oversimplify and make it sound more pop psychology or, you know, beware of that danger out there, right, type thing, to where it's like there's, you know, there's more creative ways of doing it and such. But yeah.
There's a sequence that involves Celebrimbor, the great Elvin Smith, who, by the way, love the casting, think the actor Charles Edwards is doing a really great job. But there's a sequence, first when High King Gil-galad introduces Celebrimbor, and then when Elrond and Celebrimbor are talking, that they use very corporate language. They use a very industrial, contemporary business sort of speak. And that struck me as being the wrong tone, the wrong note to strike. Tolkien, of course, deplored industrialization and would not admire our large mega corporations today. Side note, though, that is when Celebrimbor is starting to make some very poor decisions that will result in most unfortunate events later on. Perhaps they're using that language intentionally in that way. If so, good on them. That's awesome. If not, then the tone was off, I think. Now, what was I disappointed in as a Tolkien adaptation? How long is this show? So this is the part that if you listeners don't want spoilers, fast forward a little bit, because here I'll get into the particulars. I mentioned earlier, since there's so little material they can use, it seems odd and inexplicable not to use what's there and to depart dramatically. But we have to look at changes from a couple of different points of view. We have to look at, is the change necessary in the shift of medium, right? When you go from page to screen, some changes are absolutely going to be necessary. And then we have to look at, do they forward the story or not? And finally, do they seem consistent with Tolkien's worldview, his priorities, his main themes and ideas, and so forth. And I want to give a shout out, a thank you to the Rings of Power wrap-up show from The Prancing Pony for bringing in a Tolkien letter in which Tolkien actually laid out those differences himself for how to evaluate an adaptation. There are many things that seem inconsistent with Tolkien's worldview, theological beliefs, and ideas. One major one is the character of Galadriel. We do know some about Galadriel in this era, not much. We do know she was a warrior, she was a ruler, she was a very powerful person. She is the greatest of all of the Noldorian elf, except perhaps Feanor himself. So she's the first or second greatest elf. So therefore, I have no problem with her being a warrior, a commander, a great ruler, a driven person. But she's driven by simple revenge in the show, and her motivations in Tolkien's world are much more complex, not necessarily more admirable, because arrogance and pride are very big motivations for her. She desires to have a kingdom to rule herself, as she would, with no one else's interference in the books. But making her into this cold, simple, single-minded person with little compassion and not even much ambition, I think has flattened out her character and made it more two-dimensional. However, I heard from the showrunners that what we're seeing now in these characters is not what we will see by the end. Again, they have 50 episodes in which to take these characters from where we see them now to the beloved or hated characters of the Third Age, the ones that we know later on. So we shouldn't expect this Galadriel and Elrond and so forth to be the ones we know from The Lord of the Rings time period. It'll be interesting to watch them get there. But I'm just disappointed that Galadriel's character seems to be oversimplified. Connected to that, the most universally despised moment in the show among Tolkien fans and scholars is the change made to the nature of Elves exile from Valinor. So for those who aren't familiar, Valinor is, simplistically speaking, the land of the gods, the lands of the Valar, who are sort of like archangels or demigods in Tolkien's universe. They came down to the world, to Arda, and created this kind of Edenic land. And then some of them chose to leave to come to Middle-earth, the continent where elves and men and dwarves and hobbits are, to fight the great enemy Morgoth. Some of them came for less admirable motivations, to seek down and rescue the jewels that he stole from them. That was the elves who had that motivation. So the gods and the elves come to Middle-earth and they fight, and then of course the majority of them go home. Well, there are two different versions of Galadriel's story in Tolkien's text for why she left Valinor and then why she stays in Middle-earth. And Again, they are slightly less than admirable reasons. In one, she's a little too closely associated with a great revolt against the gods. Not a direct participant herself, but a little too closely involved. And in the second, it's that desire to rule a kingdom for herself. Okay. In the show, the script gives the high elvish king Gil-galad the right to permit warriors to sail back to Valinor, which just seems utterly perplexing from a Tolkienian point of view. He's an elf. He does not have the right to do that. Most importantly, he does not have the right to bar them from going there. And if he doesn't have the right to bar them, then how would he have the right to give them the permission to go? And then Galadriel refuses that gift in this show, which is consistent with her choice to stay in Middle-earth, but they have her get right to the threshold. And the purity and transcendence of Valinor in Tolkien's world is such that I don't think anyone could refuse the call once they get so close and see the clouds opening and see Valinor there. Furthermore, her quest for vengeance is because of Sauron's murder of her brother. And in Tolkien's metaphysics of the elvish afterlife, she would be reunited with her brother in Valinor. And that seems to be completely erased from the show so far. So that's my biggest concern from the show as a Tolkien adaptation. There are many, many others. Everyone can easily find them on the internets where everyone is chatting about it. There are some that are not bad. The innovation of a friendship between Elrond and Durin, the Prince of the Dwarves, I think is a good innovation. The introduction of the Harfoots, the Hobbit ancestors, I was very skeptical of that beforehand. I thought they were just there kind of to appeal to folks who like hobbits, and that they were going to be very, very corny, that they were going to be kind of not given dignity as a people. But I was wrong. So I'm pleased with that storyline. Tolkien does say somewhere that hobbits have been around since the Elder Days, which is the First Age. So the showrunners have every right to put them in the Second Age as long as they don't change the storylines, because none of the big people knew about them. And the showrunners have actually done pretty well with that by showing us how the hobbits hide from the notice of all the other peoples. So those are a few points, and I'm sure some others will come up as we go along.
Following up, though, on Galadriel and her motivation,
yes.
I know I saw some criticism that, oh, she's just seeking revenge, but then I saw someone else summarize it as she was picking up her brother's quest.
That's right.
And so right now, does the show seem to be leaning more towards it's more revenge-ish, or people are losing sight of, well, she's picking up, or it's hard to really judge
right.
with just two episodes.
It is threefold. You are correct. It is a threefold motivation. Vengeance for Finrod's death, picking up Finrod's quest against Sauron, but also trying to protect Middle-earth against this growing evil. So you're right. It's a little more complex than that, and hopefully the show will reveal that as we go and make her a more interesting character. Can I say a bit more about her brother, about Finrod? The death of Finrod in Tolkien's writings is part of one of the most important, most beautiful, and saddest stories that he ever wrote, which is the tale of Beren and Lúthien. It was the tale closest to his heart because he equated himself and his wife to these two characters, and their graves even say Beren and Lúthien on them. Now, the show could not touch that material. They have no rights to any of the Beren and Lúthien material. So they did something kind of clever. You may recall they show Finrod being dragged away by orcs in battle and shouting, and we do not see him killed. We just see him sort of overwhelmed by a crowd of orc warriors, cut to his body dead, lying on a slab, and Galadriel weeping over him. Any number of things could have happened in that cut, right? A great deal of time could have happened. So they're sort of leaving space in their editing there for you as a reader to insert the whole Beren and Lúthien story and the very particular horrific, tragic, and self-sacrificial way that Finrod actually dies. So I like that, but at the same time, Galadriel's voiceover contradicts it. They just left out the voiceover because she says, "My brother died hunting the enemy," which was not the way it is in Tolkien. Is it possible that Galadriel is wrong and she will find out more later in the show? Or is this all we're going to get? Does it matter? You know, we know Finrod died resisting Sauron in any case. So overall, it's consistent, and they have the rights to go where they want to with this tale. They are themselves artists with their own skills and talents. They can tell the story they want. But I just thought it was interesting that they cleverly left that space in their editing for our Tolkien imaginations to fill in.
Well, speaking of the artists involved, you have the opportunity to go to a premiere in New York. Tell us what that experience was like for you.
That was an amazing and unexpected experience. So I work at Signum University, and our president, Dr. Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor, has a popular YouTube channel and podcasts and so forth. And Amazon has reached out to these people who are sort of leaders of Tolkien fandoms and has invited them to come and get to know the show ahead of time, hoping that they will promote it to their fans, but giving them the freedom to condemn the show if they think that's what's warranted. So I was invited to go along as a representative of Signum University, and I went to New York City for a screening about a week before the show actually dropped on Amazon. And the whole experience was really, really lovely, very exciting. They treated us like royalty with hairstylists and makeup artists and a red carpet with a black carpet experience, which was nice. Black carpet is nicer for photographs. And obviously, I'm 100% aware of what Amazon is doing there with their marketing. They're hoping that if you wine and dine people and make them happy and give them a glitzy event, they will think more positively of the show. And yet, I was not asked to sign an NDA or anything of that sort. There were no restrictions put on my free ability to speak my opinion on the show, which, as you've gathered, is quite mixed. But there was a lovely reception in which some of the cast members were available. Then we saw the first two episodes in Lincoln Center there. And there was a Q&A afterwards with the showrunners who, if people aren't familiar with that term, for a TV show, it's basically kind of like director and lead writer put together is showrunner. So J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay are the showrunners for this. So that was a lovely experience, and it was nice to have a week to think about the show before the great internet furor erupted, even more than it already had been.
Oh, yes. Okay, and we'll have you talk some more about that experience here in a moment here. But now, what do you hope for the rest of the season in terms of what it will cover, acknowledging there's what is a total of five?
Five seasons.
And stuff. So what do you hope? Or your best estimate of what season one is going to cover, because they'll have four more to paint more right. of a picture.
And in case everyone's not totally familiar with this, we're going to cover the history of the Second Age in this series, which is going to involve the revealing and the rise of Sauron, eventually the forging of the Rings of Power, and then it's going to end with a terrible disaster, which if you don't know, go and read the Akalabeth in the Silmarillion so that you'll know how season five will end. I think we'll see some of the following things in season one. I think we'll find out that Galadriel is correct. The enemy is back. I don't think we'll even probably see him in season one. We may possibly, but this might be a little early, meet his disguise character, Annatar, who is Sauron in a fair form, who comes looking lovely and speaking prettily and winning the hearts of men and elves. So we may see Annatar in season one, but we might not even get there yet. I believe that we will find out who the Stranger is, Meteor Man, about whom there is a great deal of speculation. So I think we'll find out first whether he is good or evil. And they're playing it really carefully. They're giving cues for both. When Meteor Man lands, there's a Sauron theme playing, and the overhead shot looks like the Eye of Sauron, and he's pretty terrifying, and he kills all the pretty fireflies. But at the same time, there are many hints that seem to be saying, wizard, wizard, and there are scenes that even look similar to Gandalf scenes. My money is on Gandalf, which would be a little disappointing from a lore point of view, but makes sense for them trying to create consistency with the other ages of Tolkien's world. Let's see, what else might we see in season one? I do not think that we'll get as far as the forging of the Rings of Power, but Celebrimbor is up to some huge project. He's getting Elrond to recruit the dwarves to create a great forge. So perhaps we will end season one just with Celebrimbor getting the idea for the rings, or with Sauron introducing the idea of the rings, we might end with sort of a flare of fire in a forge that we know, uh-oh, something dangerous is going to be forged in this, and that might be the end of season one, setting things up for the future. I don't know how far we will get with the Hallbrand story, whether we'll find out if he is good or evil. I don't trust him, for the record. And I don't know how far we'll get with the tale of Arondir and Bronwyn. Fascinating storyline. But not sure they should be getting a mortgage on a house, though, because elf-human relations don't always end very well. I think it's going to be pretty tragic for one or both of them.
Well, let's take a pause. You've been on All About Jack before, but there'll be those who may not have heard you on these programs. So let's pause and have you share a little bit about yourself and the work you do with the Inklings.
I am currently the editor-in-chief of the Signum University Press, which is a new endeavor. We're just getting that press going, and we hope to publish a lot of works, both academic, popular, and creative, that appeal to our core audience, which is primarily first Tolkien, and then the Inklings, and then larger studies of fantasy literature, science fiction, speculative fiction, and pop culture of all kinds. But then beyond that, the greater world of European and English language literature and scholarly works of studies of literature from ancient and classical through medieval to modern, maybe particularly focusing on Germanic philology and the Middle Ages. So that's my primary job right now. I also teach at Signum University in the MA program and in the adult continuing education program. I finished my PhD not too long ago at Baylor University. And while there was a little bit of overlap with the Inklings in my dissertation, it was on occult playwrights of the early 20th century. The primary one is William Butler Yeats. The next most important character there is Charles Williams, who was a friend of Tolkien's and a member of the Inklings. So those are some of the things that I have going on. I'm co-editing a book with Dr. Brenton Dickison, The Gardeners of the Galaxies, How Other Worlds Teach Us to Care for This One. And theoretically, I have a bunch of writing and research projects of my own that are a little bit on the back burner at the moment.
Okay, but now, speaking of things editing, you did something with King Arthur a few years ago.
That's right, The Inklings and King Arthur. And that's actually why I am here with you at a conference now. I'll be speaking about the development of the Holy Grail quest in literature. So, yes, that edited collection with a lot of really wonderful scholars who contributed a wide range of perspectives on the Inklings' Arthurian works.
Okay, and I'll have a link in the show notes because I did an interview with you several years ago.
Thank you.
Well, now, earlier you mentioned about meeting those involved in the Rings of Power. What did you take away from that experience in terms of interacting with them and meeting them?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was such a privilege to meet these people. They were introduced to us in an incredibly crowded reception space, and they were sort of inserted into the crowd like two at a time at intervals and then taken out of the crowd again. Their handlers were making sure they weren't there too long. So I didn't get to speak to everyone, but I got to meet the two showrunners and two members of the cast. And my takeaway is that they are incredibly kind and generous people and that they are very, very passionate and knowledgeable about Tolkien. The two showrunners have vast knowledge of Tolkien's works, can quote from any number of his literary pieces and from his letters, and they love and admire his vision. So that's why I'm reserving judgment of the show as a whole. Otherwise, I would be much more negative based on what I've seen so far, but I'm trying to hold out hope that since they know what they're doing, I should trust them. And they even said that. They said, please be gentle in how you judge these first two. We're trying to introduce you to this vast and complex world with seven different geographical locations and cultures, and you've just read the first two pages of a long story, they said. And then the two cast members that I met were Robert Arameo, who plays Elrond, and Lloyd Owen, who plays Elendil, whom we have not met yet except possibly that figure on the ship with the sun behind him in the very last shot of Galadriel and Halbrand. And they were just delightful human beings. Robert Arameo is surprisingly shy for such a public figure, but we had an excellent conversation, including some discussion of projects with the Signum University Press that are not public knowledge yet, so hold on and wait till we can reveal that. With Lloyd Owen, I had a long conversation that went pretty deep into a few aspects of how difficult it is to adapt Tolkien, because his character Elendil is just a brief sketch. just some of the exterior events of Elendil's life. And we talked about how Tolkien is not like some other 20th century novelists who give you detailed psychological character sketches of what's going on inside the person's head, especially not in the Silmarillion or the appendices, which is the appendices are all they have access to. So basically all we get are sort of Elendil's years of life and death and his major events. So this actor, Lloyd Owen, has had to dig deep into what he's given and develop a character from just this really, really sketchy outline. So we had a good talk about that, about how Tolkien differs from some modern novelists. And then we touched on the themes of faith in the show. This is something that I'm optimistic about. I don't know if you saw the last trailer that came out before the show released. It was a shorter one. It was pretty poorly written and shot, I thought, but there was an interesting theme in it, which was a theme of faith, that several characters, I think, perhaps Miriel and Galadriel, maybe even Nori the Harfoot, said things like, something more is going on here. This was meant to happen. There's a purpose behind this. This was more than either just fate or destiny, one character says. And I believe the last line is, it's a matter of faith, or one has to have faith. So I asked Lloyd Owen if he thought the showrunners were leaning into the realities of Tolkien's own commitments as a Roman Catholic. And he said, oh, absolutely, definitely. That's very, very important to them. And you'll see more of that as the show goes on.
Ah, excellent. Okay. Well, now let's go ahead and wrap up by having you address this. That is, what do you hope will be the result of people watching Rings of Power? What might it inspire them to do? Or what do you hope it would?
Mm-hmm. So the very first expectation, which is not much, but I think important enough in today's climate, is I just hope it gives some relief, a breath of fresh air for viewers. The showrunners were asked on many occasions, is this going to be the Tolkien Game of Thrones style? People were worried, is there going to be gratuitous violence and nudity and so forth? And they said, absolutely not. They said, television has reached peak bleak, and we want to offer an alternative to that. So even if people never pick up a Tolkien book after this, I just hope that they enjoy watching it and get some escape from the difficulties of their daily lives and the clamor of the culture that we live in. Tolkien wrote about escape as a positive thing in On Fairy Stories and about refreshment and restoration of the spirit and so forth. And I think it will do that because it's lovely. It's a tale of the fight of good versus evil. That is, the show itself is clearly on the side of good. We'll see what happens at the end of season 5. But clearly, when evil wins in this universe, that is to be deplored and not celebrated. A second thing that I hope comes out of this show is that people who previously could not imagine themselves inhabiting Tolkien's Middle Earth now could. And I think it is an absolutely beautiful thing that each of the cultures that they're presenting in this world has a female protagonist. And I love that there is a multicultural cast, that there is an elf who is played by a black actor, and that there are actors of many ethnicities and backgrounds. So I hope that little girls watching this show and people of color watching this show will say, wow, there's a place in Middle Earth for me. That would be a really lovely result that would come out of this. And then finally, I just hope that more people read Tolkien's works or go further in his works than they have before into the Silmarillion and so forth. Maybe consider taking a course or joining a book club, because what often happens from these works is that communities grow out of them. People find a place where they belong. They find other nerds and geeks and gamers and literary lovers and scholars and come together to talk about it in community. And that's a really beautiful thing.
Oh, excellent. Well, that's a great way to end. Thank you, Serena, for sharing your thoughts about Rings of Power. Again, this is just episode 1 and 2 from season 1.
Thank you very much, William. It's been a great delight.
I also want to thank you, the listener, for joining me for this episode of All About Jack, one of the many resources from the website, EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator and producer of the show. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including a series that's new entitled The Latest on C.S. Lewis. Each 5 to 6 minute show provides 3 main stories about the newest happenings related to Lewis, along with 3 additional brief mentions. Plus, I highlight a book by Lewis you may have overlooked, a book about him that is invaluable to have, and some unusual fact about him. then I spotlight a few things from my own content. This series is part of my YouTube channel, Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today you heard an interview with Serena Higgins about her reaction to the first two episodes from Season 1 of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. You'll find a link in the show notes about Serena, including links to other times she has been on All About Jack, as well as other Tolkien content that I've had. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.